Hello and welcome to the Metagenics Institute. My name is Dr. Bianca Garrilli, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Jennifer Ryan, a naturopathic physician, in the first of a two-part podcast on the topic of digestive health and intestinal hyperpermeability. Jennifer Ryan is a principal investigator and adjunct faculty member at National University of Natural Medicine in Portland, Oregon. Her research projects have primarily focused on nutrition and dietary supplements that have digestive and cardiovascular health applications. Current projects involve botanicals, probiotics, prebiotics, and the gut microbiome. Dr. Ryan teaches courses in the Master of Science in Nutrition and Master of Science in Integrative Medicine research programs at NUNM. Prior to her clinical training, Dr. Ryan worked in several basic science research laboratories, including the UC San Diego branch of Ludwig Institute for Cancer Research. She has co-authored publications in a wide variety of medical journals, including Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Journal of Biological Chemistry, and Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine, to name just a few. So welcome, Jen. I'm very excited to speak with you today on the topic of digestive health. And, you know, you and I, being naturopathic physicians, we often view a wide variety of health and disease patterns through the lens of the gut. So I really love that you'll be focusing on the evidence surrounding this topic today of digestive health and intestinal hyperpermeability. So many people refer to intestinal hyperpermeability as leaky gut. And to begin our conversation today, I'd really like to set the stage with some definitions. Can you give me some background on what leaky gut or intestinal hyperpermeability is?
Yeah, so the short version is that leaky gut is the increased permeability of the cells that line our GI tract. Now, that being said, it's so much more fascinating than that. So what I want to cover today is really delving into the evidence base that describes what increased permeability actually means. And so first of all, I want to be clear that it's normal physiology for our GI tract to be transiently leaky or permeable. Our enterocytes have to be permeable so that we can absorb nutrients and excrete waste. But on the other hand, they have to protect us. They act as an immune barrier and a mechanical barrier. So in order to balance these two main functions, our enterocytes have to be selectively permeable. And as most of our listeners will recall probably from our very first biology lecture, selective permeability is a defining feature of a cell membrane. And where permeability becomes an issue is when we have an imbalance that causes our enterocytes to be chronically or overly permeable.
So that's interesting. It sounds like a normal intestine does have some permeability, but then there's this hyperpermeability issue as we move into this chronic disease piece. Can you tell us a little bit more about the normal intestinal permeability?
Yeah, so there are two main routes of transport through the GI epithelium. We have the transcellular route, which is through the cells, and we have the paracellular route, that's between our cells. So most of our water, our nutrients, most pharmaceutical drugs, they get absorbed transcellularly. And the material gets moved through the cell by three mechanisms. So back to basic biology, diffusion, active transport, and transcytosis. And that gets driven by concentration gradients, transport proteins, and cell signaling. And here's where I think things get more interesting. The transcellular route actually mediates the paracellular route. So this happens when the concentration of nutrients in our lumen exceeds the capacity of that transcellular pathway. A signaling cascade gets initiated, the paracellular pathway is upregulated, more material is allowed between the enterocytes, and that happens through our tight junctions. Now, of course, you and I and any clinician who's interested in increased permeability of the gut, we're aware of the importance of having integrity in our tight junctions. So our tight junctions are actually made up of several proteins. They connect our adjacent epithelial cells to each other, but they're not just structural. They're actually channels. They're pore-like, and they open up to allow more material through, or they close down to maintain our barrier. And here's where it really gets interesting. Our tight junctions are controlled by the cytoskeleton. So we rarely hear about the cytoskeleton anymore, but, you know, back to basic biology, the cytoskeleton is that frame-like structure of filaments and tubules that give our cells their shape and their structure. And although we're, you know, confining our discussion today just to the GI tract, I did want to point out that we have tight junctions throughout our body, not just the enterocytes. We have tight junctions in all of our endothelial cells that line our vessels and the ducts in our body. There are a few pathways that regulate tight junctions. So we have upregulation and downregulation of the tight junction proteins, pathways that promote the assembly and the maintenance of the tight junctions, and there's pathways that promote the disassembly or the breakdown of our tight junctions. And as you may recall, our enterocytes, they only need to live for a few days, so it's normal for the connections between the cells to be broken down frequently, but only if the cells being replaced. So when those tight junctions disassemble, of course, we lose homeostasis. We're more likely to absorb large molecules like antigenic proteins, bacterial LPS, and then that just perpetuates additional damage and inflammation. So to summarize, our tight junctions, they're dynamic. They're not just static and structural. They're pore-like. They open up really quickly in response to a signaling cascade. It's normal for them to be opened transiently, but not to be open all the time. And it's also not normal for them to be breaking down or disassembling all the time. So to circle back to that original question, intestinal hyperpermeability, also called leaky gut, is an issue due to abnormal paracellular transport, and it involves tight junction dysfunction.
That's really interesting. It actually takes me back to one of our original biochemistry classes when I first started medical school. And the one thing our professor continued to hound us with in terms of remembering for the rest of our medical career is that function follows form. And so when you're talking about these tight junctions being open more chronically and that it leads to this dysfunctional, it totally comes back to what we learned during, you know, primary biochemistry classes. So what I'm interested in here is what actually causes those tight junctions to be open chronically, and then what causes that excessive breakdown that you were discussing?
Well, this is really well characterized. There are a number of regulators of tight junctions, and I want to mention a few of them because they pertain to things that I know we were planning to talk about later. So one of them is myosin light chain kinase, also known as MLCK in short. So it upregulates paracellular transport under both normal and pathologic states. So an example of a normal scenario would be in a post-exercise state when we're trying to absorb more water. If we have sodium and glucose present, more water gets absorbed transcellularly, but MLCK sends a message that tells our tight junctions to open up so that we can absorb more water paracellularly. So MLCK also acts as a signal in pathologic states, and this happens when we have acute diarrhea, when copious amounts of water end up being excreted into the lumen. Another mechanism is pro-inflammatory cytokines. So interferon gamma and TNF-alpha, they promote permeability. And the way TNF-alpha works is that it increases the expression of MLCK. Another signaling molecule that increases this paracellular transport is zonulin. When zonulin levels become elevated, our tight junctions, they disassemble, they start to fall apart. And zonulin is significant because the overexpression of zonulin is part of celiac disease pathology. We know that gliadin, the component of the gluten complex, triggers the release of zonulin from the small intestine. So when we eat wheat or gluten, gliadin triggers the release of zonulin. Zonulin then promotes the disassembly of the tight junctions, and we have increased permeability. So there is research showing that patients with celiac disease have higher levels of zonulin than healthy controls, but this has been shown to happen even in a healthy control, even when somebody doesn't have celiac disease. When we eat gluten, it triggers the release of zonulin. So again, to circle back, intestinal hyperpermeability, it's caused by an imbalance in our signaling to our tight junctions, causing them to open up or break down. And then this creates a scenario where we no longer have the necessary contact between our adjacent cells. The epithelial barrier becomes compromised because it's not being as selective as a healthy GI tract should be.
So there's quite a few different pathways, it sounds like, that this could be an issue for people. As you noted, there's these signaling molecules. There's this underlying inflammatory component that we often hone in on when we're looking at the therapeutic components. And then the zonulin levels, especially as it has to deal with celiac disease. So on this topic of celiac disease, are there other conditions where there's evidence of intestinal hyperpermeability being the underlying condition?
Yes. Well, I don't know. I wouldn't necessarily say that it's the underlying condition. You know, I know that as scientists, we need to be careful to talk about the distinction between correlation and causation. But we know that that there is a growing body of literature connecting increased permeability to the disease process for many conditions, both acute and chronic. So the chronic conditions that have the strongest data showing an association between the condition and hyperpermeability are IBD, both Crohn's and UC, IBS, and celiac disease. And something for clinicians to be aware of, even if increased permeability isn't causing frank intestinal disease, it can also cause immune activation at the mucosa subclinically. There is also emerging data demonstrating an association between a number of extraintestinal conditions. So it's a long list. Insulin resistance, diabetes 1 and 2, liver disease, both NAFLD and NASH, cardiovascular disease, RA, atopic dermatitis, and then even several neurologic diseases. So MS, Parkinson's, migraine, and autism spectrum disorders. So regarding acute conditions, as I mentioned earlier, when we have acute diarrhea, this results in grossly increased paracellular transport of fluid back into the lumen. It's actually called paracellular flux. And we know that this can happen so acutely that the dehydration that results can be life-threatening. And so the signaling involved here is really well characterized with a number of life-threatening pathogens like Vibrio cholerae, EPEC, EHEC, and C. diff. And then the strongest evidence of all, built on decades of research, is in multiple organ failure in ICU patients.
So it sounds like there's quite a bit of evidence, as you said, potentially associating this hyperpermeability component with a number of both chronic and acute situations. I know that in my clinical practice, I have a lot of patients who come in, and obviously, so they've already been self-diagnosed, right? They come in and they say, I have leaky gut, or I have hyperpermeability issues. And what we're seeing is that there's not been a lot of testing done in most cases. It's more based on symptomatology or what they've read online or what they have gathered when they've done, because a lot of my patients, when they do come in, a lot of our patients have already done quite a bit of research on their own to try to understand where their symptoms are coming from and what they might be able to do about it. And so I've seen quite a few people coming in with dermatological components, as you notice, the GI distress and illnesses, behavioral and neural components. And so there does seem to be this correlation between the gut aspect that we talk about from a naturopathic perspective and a holistic health or disease process. So I think it's quite different in many cases when we're in clinical practice versus when we're looking at the research setting. And I don't do a lot of testing in my particular practice because we do a lot of work based on symptoms and just moving straight into therapeutics if we're not looking for data that is
objective.
There you go. Thank you so much for the patient. In a lot of cases, they just want to feel better and they don't necessarily either have the means for functional testing or they lack other resources. But from a research setting, I think it's really important for us to understand what we're looking for. And so can you give me some information on what that might look like from your perspective?
Yeah, well, there's a variety of testing options available. There's way more available for use in an academic setting, animal models, ex vivo assays. But in clinical practice, we have fewer options. Because your standard high-volume lab service provider is not going to offer an intestinal permeability test. But there are a few specialty lab providers that do offer permeability assessments. So the three that I want to talk about are the lactulose mannitol test, blood zonulin levels, and an autoantibody panel. So the lactulose mannitol test is considered a functional assay. And these types of assays, they've been used for decades. It requires that the patient collects a baseline urine sample, drinks a pre-measured amount of the lactulose and mannitol, then they collect their urine for a preset period of time, and the sample is analyzed for lactulose and mannitol. So the way the test works is that lactulose and mannitol are these small, non-digestible carbohydrates. mannitol is the smaller of the two, and it should be absorbed readily transcellularly. And lactulose, the larger of the two, is believed to be absorbed paracellularly, but only if the subject actually has hyperpermeability. So when the test is interpreted, a healthy individual should absorb some of the mannitol, which acts sort of as a control, and very little lactulose should be absorbed. In some cases, though, a patient may actually have absorbed very little of the mannitol, and that may indicate that they have a pretty severe malabsorption issue, especially if their microvilli are blunted. So, I haven't read every paper out there on lactulose mannitol testing, but I have come across papers demonstrating an increased lactulose mannitol ratio in patients with Crohn's disease and celiac disease. And I want to point out that although there's several similar functional tests that use a similar methodology in a research setting, the lactulose mannitol test is the main one that clinicians in practice will have access to. But if we were to lump them all together, there's a lot more information demonstrating potentially increased permeability using these methods and a lot more conditions. The second test I wanted to mention is zonulin. So I talked about this earlier, that signaling molecule that gets increased when we consume gluten, even in healthy controls. So in addition to this marker being elevated in patients with celiac disease, it's been shown to be elevated in patients with type 1 and type 2 diabetes and fatty liver disease. And these are two issues I hadn't mentioned previously. Zonulin's been shown to be elevated in patients with PCOS and obese subjects. And the last method I wanted to mention is an autoantibody panel that many clinicians are using. So as I described earlier, our tight junctions are made up of several proteins and protein complexes. And the panel that I'm thinking of, it measures blood levels of autoantibodies to the tight junction proteins. It also measures antibodies to bacterial LPS, which we know is more likely to be absorbed paracellularly when the gut barrier is uncompromised. So if we were to compare the test, the lactulose mannitol test and other similar tests, those have the most data. But measuring zonulin and autoantibodies, they definitely don't have as much published data supporting their use. So zonulin, for example, wasn't even discovered and named until around the year 2000. So it needs time we need time for the medical literature to catch up. But on the plus side for zonulin and the autoantibody test, those assays require a non-fasting blood draw, which in most cases is going to be more user-friendly than the lactulose mannitol test because the lactulose mannitol test requires an overnight fast and then several hours of urine collection.
Well, this is very enlightening, Jen. I really appreciate all this information today. We've gone over definitions of intestinal hyperpermeability as well as reviewing the normal gut permeability and looking at pathologies associated with the hyperpermeability. You've given us some great information on some of the triggers and the signaling pathways associated with hyperpermeability, and then these great testing mechanisms for looking at the hyperpermeability in our clinical setting. So thank you so much for your time and the information today, Jen. It's really been a pleasure to speak with you on Digestive Health, and I look forward to our second podcast in this series where you'll be highlighting a therapeutic approach with the research backing those recommendations for intestinal hyperpermeability.
Yeah, and I look forward to the next podcast. And I know I mentioned gluten today, but there are other dietary factors that I wanted to discuss, microflora imbalances that contribute, lifestyle factors that can promote permeability, and then, as you mentioned, get talking about treatment. So there's a lot more to talk about.
That's going to be wonderful. I look forward to it. Thank you to our listeners for being with us today. To access this podcast and others, please visit our website at mhicn.com.